Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll get the latest in the bitter tribal dispute that turned violent last week and shut down a popular mountain area resort and casino. Ezra David Romero was in the middle of the struggle between the rival factions of the Chukchansi tribe, and he'll give us a report on what's next for the troubled Coarse Gold Casino. We'll also continue our coverage of the November election and look at some of the ballot measures that will go before voters next month. And we'll hear the first of two interviews with the candidates in the closely watched state Senate race between Andy Vidak and Luis Chavez. And you'll want to stay with us because we'll wrap up today's show with a very tasty treat, a preview of this weekend's Springville Apple Festival. But first, California's economy may be on the mend, but how fast it's bouncing back from the Great Recession depends on where you live. That's why our partners at Capital Public Radio and KPCC are teaming up this week to bring you stories of how California's major urban areas are recovering. We're calling our series Fits and Starts, which airs every afternoon this week on All Things Considered. Today, we get a sneak preview of tonight's broadcast with Capital Public Radio's Julia Mitrich and her look at the Central Valley, where a few bright spots are beginning to emerge after a brutal last few years.
The collapse of the housing market devastated cities like Stockton and Modesto. But the Central Valley's agriculture industry weathered the recession just fine. It even saw record growth, with one painful exception, dairy.
It was a bloodbath.
Tom Barcellus owns T-Bar Dairy here in Porterville.
And some people who were on a rented place, all they had was equity in their cows, those are the ones that hurt the worst. Those are the ones that actually went out of business first. And unfortunately, some hung on until they had nothing. Others saw it coming and sold out.
Barcellus survived the crisis because on top of his 1,500 cows, he has land. So when feed prices skyrocketed and milk prices sank, he cut costs by growing feed himself. On this balmy October afternoon, 5 years later, a worker drives a vehicle along the edge of the corral. He's pushing fresh feed toward T-Bar's herd. Milk prices are strong, feed costs have fallen a bit, but there's still one thing that has Barcellus worried.
Everything is wonderful except the drought, except the water.
The drought may have added insult to injury, but economist Jeff Michael with University of the Pacific says that's not the real source of the Valley's economic woes.
It really was housing and the public sector completely collapsing.
Sacramento in particular was decimated by public sector layoffs, furloughs, and salary freezes. And even in the best of times, Central Valley unemployment rarely drops as low as it did right before the recession. Today, jobless rates in some valley counties are starting to dip under 10% after reaching as high as 16%. The public sector is adding jobs again, and the housing market is starting a comeback.
It's off the floor. It's still on its knees, but it's lifting a little bit, and they've seen some recovery in values, and that's helping the broader economy a little bit, too.
The Sacramento region, for example, has seen its median home price rebound about halfway to where it was at the peak of the housing bubble. And in Bakersfield, another industry is jump-starting economic recovery.
You know, from where our yard is to pull up on. And just make sure you all your lines where you're at, what you're doing.
At sunrise, the Kern River oil fields are cool and surprisingly quiet. In the work yard behind Robin's EnviroVac, a small business that cleans up oil spills, a crew picks up work orders and runs maintenance checks on a very odd piece of equipment. That's a very powerful suction vehicle called a guzzler. It sucks up dirt and water without damaging oil or power lines. For company supervisor Vince Nigro, there's never a dull moment working in the oil fields.
It's a little bit of everything. It's a little complex. It's a little difficult. It's dangerous.
The oil industry is leading Bakersfield's recovery thanks to new exploration and investment. And for Nigro, it's a reliable job, no small thing. He knows plenty of folks in construction who aren't landing steady work.
You know, they'll be working one day, and next day, well, hey, everybody's getting laid off. It's not booming like the oil fields or working in the hospital or any medical or anything like that. Those are the two best fields to be in here in Bakersfield.
As for the future here?
You know, it's a good town to move to if you're looking for work. You have the oil fields here, so there's a lot of opportunities in the oil fields. I would tell people if they want looking for work, come to Bakersfield.
Which just goes to show, even parts of the Central Valley are seeing new economic life. I'm Julia Mitrich.
You can find photos, infographics, and more on our series Fits and Starts on our website at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. Factions of the Chukchansi Indians have been going at it for decades. Last week, their tribal dispute escalated to a boiling point, endangering the public, when armed factions clashed inside the casino in an effort to take control of contested documents. FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports on what's next for the Chukchansi Gold Resort and Casino in Coarse Gold.
In the hills of Madera County, a 25-year-old family dispute has surfaced. The Picayune Rancheria of the Chukchansi Indians is split into three factions over family conflicts that have sued for generations. And now the fight has escalated into the alleged loss of millions of dollars, missing audit, and the control of the tribe's main source of income.
Very much like a family business in turmoil. There is no bad guys. There is no good guys. There's just a lot of confusion.
That's Victor Rocha, who runs a Native American news site, Pechanga.net. He knows all about tribal friction.
One of the things that I tell people about Indian country, you know, we talk about how we look ahead towards seven generations. Well, we also carry the grudges of seven generations behind us with us. Now you add the equation of money, you know, that always makes for an interesting stew of calamity.
On Friday, state and federal authorities ordered the closure of the Chukchansi Gold Resort and Casino after one of the factions tried to take it over at gunpoint Thursday, endangering over 500 employees and visitors in the building.
They went in there and tasered security guards. They still have to prove that this place is not a safety hazard.
At some point during the takeover, a fire alarm was pulled, the casino was evacuated, and the factions locked themselves in two different parts of the building. Rocha says the Native American world is watching the situation very carefully.
In one hand, it is absurd, and everybody's just appalled by it. But in the other hand, it's a learning lesson for the rest of us.
The latest chapter in the conflict began last week, when the federal government announced it would shut down the casino unless audits and other financial information were turned in by October 27th. The faction led by Tex McDonald claims it attempted the takeover in order to retrieve the audit information.
They didn't want to do an audit. They stole money from us. $11 million were just missing since they've been in power. So we come in and we want to know what happened to it, and we want to bring criminal charges against them.
But the other factions who ran the casino at the time refused to hand over the documents. And on Friday, when McDonald's group tried to remove paperwork, an argument ensued between the opposing groups.
Get my vehicle up here now.
This is attempt
Tell
to
them
repossess.
They need it up here now.
It says they shall not attempt to repossess or take control of the casino. These are casino documents.
These are not casino documents.
But the documents only made it a few feet outside the casino's front door before Madera County Sheriff John Anderson brought them inside, which is where they'll stay until Wednesday when all three factions appear in federal court in Fresno. Sheriff Anderson has worked with the tribe for years.
I'm glad to see that finally someone at the state level and someone at the federal level listened to us and said, wait a minute, somebody's got to do something about this. They don't listen to the sheriff. A lot of times they say, come in here, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. And then when we come in there and do something, the other side, wait a minute, you can't do that. We're a sovereign nation.
But not everyone is relieved. The temporary closure is making it hard for Diane Avery, who's worked in housekeeping at the resort for 3 years, to pay her bills.
It hurts us because we need two paychecks to make it. And with this, who knows when that place is going to open, if it's going to open back up.
Perhaps Avery's husband, Gene, sums up the situation the best.
Nobody knows who the bad guys are. Nobody knows who the good guys are. So why don't you just get together and be a team and make it work? Every other casino around has done that. There's money to be made.
And if the casino ever opens back up, it may have a hard time attracting visitors. Jenny Reyes and her family drove from Paso Robles Friday to spend the weekend at the casino, but were turned away.
I think that they should have just given us the courtesy to call us because we've made reservations 2 weeks in advance. I'm never coming to this casino again.
But until the tribe comes to an agreement, law enforcement, including officers and policemen from Fresno and Madera, will guard the casino and turn away any patrons that stop by. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. On November 4th, California voters will decide the fate of a $7.5 billion bond intended to improve the state's water system. Proposition 1 is one of the most closely watched measures on the ballot. Proponents of the bond say it would provide safe and reliable water. Opponents say it wrongly focuses on building more dams. And as Capital Public Radio's Amy Quinton reports, the bond has even divided some environmental groups.
My guess is this could be a 3-ton crop. I'm very encouraged. This looks good.
It's harvest time for Stan Lester, a fourth-generation farmer from Winters, California, in Solano County. Lester stands in his walnut orchard, watching a huge machine shaped like a giant claw shake walnuts from the trees. Lester says despite the drought, his crop looks good this year. But it hasn't been easy. He depends on groundwater.
The water this year, because of the lack of rainfall, and because we've had to put additional water on our crops to supplement the lack of rainfall, the water table never recovered.
Lester says the underground aquifer relies on surface water from rivers and streams to help replenish it. But rivers and streams are drying up. It's one of the reasons he supports the water bond and the $2.7 billion it sets aside for storage.
We know the weather is, you know, unpredictable in California, and especially lately. And so we need to set aside water and store water in these reservoirs in time of need.
Storage was the key sticking point in getting the legislature to pass the water bond with the 2/3 vote it needed. That portion of the bond includes reservoirs and projects to clean up or store more groundwater. Two proposed dams could receive some of the bond money, Sites Reservoir north of Sacramento and Temperance Flat east of Fresno. Barbara Berrigan-Perilla with Restore the Delta says those dams are just one of the reasons they're opposed to the bond.
The proposed dam projects that are actually mentioned, those dams will be operated in a way to work with the tunnels and have negative impacts on the Delta.
Legislators said they crafted the bond so that it would neither help nor hurt Governor Jerry Brown's proposal to build twin tunnels under the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Berrigan Perilla says Prop 1 is not tunnel neutral. While the governor and legislature, farmers and water agencies support the bond, environmental groups are split.
The Planning and Conservation League has been an active supporter of every water bond approved by the voters for the last 20 years.
Jonas Minton is with the Planning and Conservation League. The group isn't taking a position on this water bond. Neither is the Sierra Club.
In this case, we're really having to look closely at the balance of what's good in the bond versus what's not so good.
Environmentalists favor the $520 million the bond would provide for safe, clean drinking water, the $1.4 billion to protect rivers and other watersheds, and another almost $2 billion for water recycling and groundwater sustainability. Catherine Phillips is with the Sierra Club.
There is an opportunity and a need to change the way we deal with water, and there are things in this bond that will help do that.
But both the Sierra Club and the Planning and Conservation League are opposed to the construction of dams, which they say would be environmentally damaging and provide a limited new supply. The water bond doesn't guarantee construction of dams, but Minton says it sets up a competitive process for storage projects based on their benefits.
The criteria for what's a benefit to be counted is recreational benefits. Well, to the best of my knowledge, you still cannot do water skiing on groundwater. So it gives a competitive advantage.
If the water bond does pass, it's unlikely to end the state's water wars. Instead, there will likely be a new debate over how to spend that storage money. It also comes during California's historic drought, something that may be hard for voters to ignore. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. As the November election approaches, one state proposition has drawn the most money from top contributors. Proposition 46 would raise the cap on pain and suffering damages in medical malpractice cases. But as healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone tells us from Sacramento, the measure could change the way doctors practice.
Proposition 46 is actually three measures in one. It would require drug testing of doctors. It would require physicians to check a database before prescribing patients addictive substances. And it would raise the limit on damages awarded in medical malpractice suits. If that seems like a lot to take in, consumer watchdog's Carmen Balber says the measure was deliberately written that way.
You write a measure so it'll be successful at the polls. The stupidest thing you could do in an initiative campaign is write an initiative that the public doesn't understand and doesn't want.
But opponents say the measure is carelessly thrown together. Dr. Ruth Haskins is with the California Medical Association.
This initiative is really about raising the cap, and everything else is just a distraction.
The cap is the $250,000 limit on pain and suffering awards in medical malpractice suits. It was set in 1975 under MICRA, the Medical Injury Compensation Reform Act. Prop 46 would raise the cap to over $1 million. Dr. Haskins says that would make medical liability premiums go up.
Physicians just won't be able to afford to practice medicine in California.
The California Medical Association says governments and taxpayers will pay more, too. Dr. Haskins, who is an obstetrician and gynecologist, says it would make doctors like her change the way they practice to avoid lawsuits.
If this passes, I might be saying, let's order that ultrasound now to see if there's a problem. And that ultrasound is going to be an increased cost to the medical healthcare system.
But attorneys say the current cap on damages already affects how they work. Sacramento law firm Kershaw, Cutter & Ratnoff says the cap forces lawyers to make business decisions about medical malpractice cases.
We probably take 5% or less of the cases that are presented to us.
Attorney J.R. Parker says it costs tens of thousands of dollars to build a case, so most of their cases involve the prospect of significant financial awards. Young people whose injuries have prevented them from working, or people who require lifetime medical care. MICRA does not cap those economic losses. Parker says he's extremely selective about pain and suffering cases.
Wrongful death cases are one of the best examples where even if you've got, you know, a lost grandfather or a lost child, there's no real loss of earning capacity that anyone could attach to that death. And so, you know, the grisly reality of MICRA is that those cases are only worth $250,000.
Parker says those limitations don't apply with other causes of injury.
The same kinds of injury that happen to be caused by a defective product or a truck driver that falls asleep or any number of circumstances where someone is negligent, doesn't do what they were supposed to do, and somebody's injured as a result, the jury gets to decide how much that injury is worth in terms of pain and suffering.
Lifting the damage cap has been considered in the legislature without success. Wesley Hussey, government professor at Sacramento State University, says that's typically the point at which proponents take a measure to voters. He says the drug testing and the prescription drug database aspects of Prop 46 are sweeteners added to win public favor.
And so it's really about changing MICRA. But we found over the years that kind of complicated technical issues like that don't work well with the voters. So proponents have found something that's easier to talk about, kind of bring voters in on that issue, and then they get what they really want, which is the change to MICRA.
He says sweeteners aren't inherently bad, but they don't always work. They can confuse voters, and confused voters often vote no.
They're very good at making decisions on social issues where it's just basically their values and their preferences, but kind of complicated and technical issues, voters don't understand that. And throwing money around to scare them or convince them to vote for it, that's how propositions work often, sadly, in California.
Lifting the cap would allow attorneys to earn more money on cases. Doctors are concerned about costs to their industry. Both professions bring in an average salary of more than $150,000 a year. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Stay with us. Coming up later this hour on Valley Edition, a trip to the Springville Apple Festival. And why is Visalia's art scene thriving? We'll find out how arts can revive a town coming up on Valley Edition. With the November election just around the corner, two races in the Central Valley are attracting a lot of attention. Last week, All Things Considered featured a piece about the congressional contest between Republican David Valadao and Democratic challenger Amanda Renteria. It's a district that leans to Democrats, at least when it comes to voter registration. And it's a race that's drawn national attention as one of a handful across the country that could go to either party. Well, in the California Senate, there's a district and a race that's quite similar. Republican cherry farmer Andy Vidak currently holds the seat in a district that had been controlled by Democrats until Michael Rubio resigned to become a lobbyist for Chevron. He's facing off against Democrat and Fresno Unified School District board member Luis Chavez. This race is also getting a lot of attention, as it's one of the only state Senate races that is genuinely competitive, meaning that it very well could decide whether Democrats can cement a two-thirds majority in the Senate. We've extended an invitation to both campaigns to join us on Valley Edition, and we hope to bring you an interview with Andy Vidak next week on our show. But yesterday, I had a chance to sit down with Luis Chavez and ask him about his thoughts on some of the state's most controversial issues, from fracking to high-speed rail. Luis Chavez joins us now here at Valley Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on and giving us this opportunity to reach your listeners.
This is your first time running for a larger office. How does this compare with running for school board and serving the residents of Fresno Unified?
Sure. Well, it's kind of like, you know, when you go to a Grizzly game, that's like the little leagues. This is like going to a Giants game, big leagues. It's a very big district. It's about 2 hours and 45-minute drive from the southern point of the district to the northern point. So it's a lot of communities, a lot of cities, but it's definitely different with regards to the demographics too, very diverse communities. We've got the best of both worlds. We've got urban areas with Fresno, with Bakersfield, with Hanford, and we also have some rural communities out there as well. So it's good. It's a big district, and that's one of the reasons why we started so early.
Now, you've been known to voters in the Fresno area for some time now. For our listeners in Bakersfield on KPRX, you're a relatively new name. One of the big issues there in Kern County is the oil industry and specifically hydraulic fracturing. It's been something that's been going on in Kern County for decades. The state has recently passed some new regulations on hydraulic fracturing. There are also other bills that have been out there in recent years that would do more things, even potentially put a moratorium on that practice. What do you think about the current regulations regarding fracking? Are they enough?
Sure. I think the governor did a really good job with brokering, you know, the compromise between the environmental community and the oil industry down there. And, I mean, you just can't neglect the fact that Kern produces about 75% of the oil in the state. Their economy is obviously dependent on it, but we also have to have some safeguards in place to make sure they're protecting the water and the air down there. And one of the components that I do like about that is that you have to notify the adjacent property owner whenever there's fracking going on, and obviously monitor that, and we have to have that because we have to protect the water. Agriculture is dependent on it. And then a big problem that we have here in Central Valley too is access to clean drinking water. So there has to be safeguards, and you know, I think the governor did a good job of brokering that compromise, and we have a process in place for that now.
You mentioned drinking water, and that's another big issue right now. The governor recently signed three bills that for the first time will regulate new wells in the Central Valley throughout the state in a way that they haven't been regulated before. And that came despite the opposition of many in the Valley, many of the Valley's elected representatives. How would you have voted on those bills, and what do you think about that legislation that's now law?
Sure. I didn't get a chance to read the complete law. What I do think we have to have is a process in place where you have to give everybody a equal playing field, right? We have some wells that are running dry in East Porterville. We have some wells that are running dry in Kings County. And the cost, and not just the cost, but the waiting time to go about drilling that, I mean, has gotten just so long. We've been hit by 3 years of hard drought. We have to have a management plan. I think now that the law has passed, we need to really move in making sure that we have that local input and that local control, because if we don't, then we're going to actually just exacerbate the drought and the consequences that we've had, especially for those communities. A couple of weeks ago, the city of Avenal was in danger of losing their access to clean drinking water. So we have to have a process in place to ensure that everybody has access to that, our farmers, our small businesses, our, more importantly, our residents. Access to clean drinking water is a big, big need out there. I was actually out in Seville. You know, everybody knows that the UN came out and monitored that, and it was just eye-opening experience for me, because here we have a community that is predominantly farm workers, and yet they get their drinking water from a ditch that is for runoff for farms. So obviously, I just scratched my head on that and thinking, why would they do that? Well, it would have been easier to just purchase the adjacent right-of-way, so that they don't have that in there. Now, they did install a well on there, but, you know, again, to your question, I think we absolutely have to have a process in place. We just need to make sure that our local folks are included in that conversation.
Speaking of water, another big issue out there is this plan for the Bay Delta plan, these tunnels that would be dug under the Delta. Right now, it's been cast into some doubt as to whether the federal government would sign off on that, and they've asked the state to recirculate that environmental document. In this part of the valley, it seems like every politician who's running for office is in support of water, water for farms, water for people. What do you think about that? Because many in your party are on the other side of that issue in regards to concerns about health of the Delta ecosystem, in regards to endangered species. How comfortable would you be maybe opposing members of your party if it came down to a vote on a BDCP?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I ultimately represent the Central Valley, and, you know, we have a lot of challenges here. And if we can figure out a way of getting additional water here, absolutely, I would support that, you know, because at the end of the day, we live here. I understand the concerns that they have throughout other parts of the state, but we also have some needs here in the Central Valley. So we could figure out a way of getting additional clean drinking water. I'd be supportive of that 100%. Absolutely.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Luis Chavez. He's a candidate for the vacant state Senate seat, facing off against incumbent Andy Vidak. There has been a lot of talk about the looming implementation of cap and trade as it applies to gasoline and diesel fuel. Many here in the Valley are opposed. In fact, even a member of your own party, Henry T. Perea, drafted a bill that would have delayed implementation of that, what some people call a tax. How do you feel on that issue?
Sure. I mean, we have to have a process in place now. You know, we have to comply with AB 32. That's the law of the land. Governor signed this already. But I do have some concerns as well, and I'll give you a couple of examples. I was in the city of Avenal, and one of the things that our district does not have that other parts of the state do have is access to public transportation. Quick example was there's a lady there, senior, that has to go and get dialysis treatment in Hanford, and she doesn't have access to transportation. So she has to, you know, fill up her car and use gas. So, yeah, that's going to hit particularly low-income families out there in their pocketbooks. Now, having said that, the law is already in place. I think my role as a legislator would be finding ways of mitigating that, particularly for rural areas that don't have access to those big transportation hubs that other parts of the state. But look, for me, it's simple. If it benefits my district, I'll support it. If it doesn't, then I won't, because ultimately you're responsible to the constituents that you represent.
So would you have voted for the Perea bill if you were in office and it would have come to a vote, which it did not?
To postpone it?
Yeah, to postpone.
Probably would have. I didn't read the complete bill, but I would have wanted to have more inputs, particularly from those small rural communities. And ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, we have to have a comprehensive plan. Obviously, everybody knows that. But at we also have to find ways of mitigating those impacts for smaller communities, rural areas. And one of the things I've seen out there as I've gone from town to town is just a huge disinvestment in infrastructure and access to water treatment plants, to roads, to transportation. So we have to be careful about how we go about implementing certain policies, because at the end of the day, we all want to get there. But the discussion is always how do we get there, right? So yeah, it had to be a good comprehensive plan with input from those small communities. I would definitely had that in place.
What do you think about the recent Court of Appeals decision in the Vergara case regarding teacher tenure?
Sure. I mentioned this earlier. You know, we talk about in this conversation, a big piece of that's missing is, and this is something that I learned because I was a teacher. I worked in the classroom. I don't believe that fear of losing your job is what motivates someone to go into the education field. But we also have to have high levels of quality teaching and learning going on in our classroom, particularly for those students. That's why I'm a big supporter of the LCFF formula, where for the first time we recognize that certain students need additional resources. And one of those key components is on having good teachers. I think for me, as I say this as an educator, that needs to be decided at the bargaining table with each. And, you know, I've had to make those decisions. I've had to vote to fire bad teachers, and I've had to vote to retain good teachers. So we need to have that. And I think when you just boil the argument down to blaming it on teachers, well, it's not just the teacher's job. It's also the community. It's also the parents. That's a big component that we have missing from that conversation. And one of the things I found out when I started teaching was that it's hard to teach a child that comes to your class hungry. It's hard to teach a child that comes to your class when they have domestic violence or substance abuse issues going on at home. But at the same time, again, we have to make sure that we have good teachers in the classroom. And I think we have a process in place that addresses that.
Recently, the new Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon and Speaker Tony Atkins held an event. They were asked about their priorities for the new year, and the issue of Proposition 30 came up, whether to extend Prop 30. And this is the sales and income tax increase that was passed by voters 2 years ago. It's been largely credited with improving the state's finances. Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon said he was open to potentially extending Prop 30. Speaker Atkins said she had some concerns about that. What do you think about the potential of extending what was supposed to be a temporary tax increase?
Sure. Well, we have to obviously, there's been a big disinvestment in education throughout the state. I don't think we invest enough in our future, which are our children. But for me personally, I would be directly, you know, with what the governor said, put it on the ballot. I want to see what outcomes we've had with those resources. I'm not just a fan of throwing money at an issue and seeing to see if it works. I would actually want to see what kind of outcomes we'd have with regards to education, with regards to what impacts it's had on those particular students that those dollars were targeted at. And then we'd have that conversation later. But I think we absolutely need to invest more in education. And that's a key component of it. But I say let the voters decide. And I'm confident that if we've done a good job up to that point, then they'll renew it.
Before we go, one last question about one hot issue here in the Valley, and this one that divides Governor Brown and many here in Central California, and that's high-speed rail. Mm-hmm. Your opponent is one of the biggest critics of high-speed rail. Governor Brown is one of the biggest supporters of the project. It's something that supporters say would transform the Valley and make the economy here much more diversified, having commuters commuting from Bakersfield and Fresno to L.A. and San Francisco. How do you think high-speed rail would affect the Valley? Harm, hurt, anywhere in between?
Well, it's, especially with when I have this conversation, I've had this conversation many a times in the town hall meetings. I can tell you that that's probably one of the most common denominators. And, you know, my position has been clear. I mean, this was a voter-approved project, and we have to make sure that the project is implemented in a timely manner. I think the conversation is moving away from if it's happening or not to guess what? It's already happening. We've got 52 companies, local companies here in the area that already have hard hats on job sites, that already have boots on the ground. It's pumping approximately $60+ million into our local economy. I think my job as a legislator will be to ensure that all of those jobs are local, and that we plug in a lot of our apprenticeship programs into that. And interesting that you mentioned that we had a town hall meeting in Porterville, and that was one of the discussions. And older gentleman, probably in his mid-70s, rose up and said, "Hey, I got a job working on the railroad, the old railroad that we had." And he was actually able to retire. So these are good paying jobs that are going to be coming here to the area, particularly if we get that maintenance yard here in the valley. I'll be advocating for that. Those will be thousands of jobs that are be paying prevailing wage and ensure that people are able to provide with their families. So I do see it as an economic booster. I think one of the areas that hasn't been explored is the fact that we have a project that will be creating these jobs. But, you know, at the same time, we also have to ensure that the rail authority is working with those local governments. We have a lawsuit by Kings County and now in Kern. And we have to ensure that, you know, we're showing respect to those communities, because I don't think that we've done a good job of reaching out and coming up with a good alignment plan. And that's really what the challenge has always been with this project, is the path that it's taking. And I think more work needs to be done on that. But the project's already happening. You see buildings coming down here and, you know, work being done. And we need to ensure that we're at the table and making sure we keep those jobs here local.
We've been talking with Luis Chavez. He is a candidate to be the next senator for this part of Central California, the next state senator. He is facing off against Republican incumbent Andy Vidak in the November 4th election. We have extended the same invitation to Mr. Vidak and hope to have him on our program next week. Luis Chavez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Can the arts revive a town? That's the question being asked in a forum that takes place this Thursday night in Visalia. The free event is produced by our partner, Zocalo Public Square. The panel discussion will take place at Arts Visalia in downtown, and the moderator for the event joins us now on the phone, James Ward, Senior Lifestyle Editor of the Visalia Times-Delta. James, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Sometimes the media gets criticized, perhaps justly, for focusing on bad news or things that need fixing. But this event produced by Zocalo is in Visalia because of what Visalia has done right in having these strong arts organizations that not only do a great job themselves, but build community. Looking at the community and what's happening right now, why do you think Zocalo chose Visalia over maybe other communities?
Well, I think you can point to this last weekend in Visalia for a perfect example. We had an incredible amount of arts and cultures events happening this weekend. We had four community theater productions, a big festival called Taste the Arts in downtown Visalia. We had a cowboy cultural music production festival that brought in some cowboy musicians into Visalia. Plus, we had two pretty big concerts at a downtown music venue called the Celador. There's always something going down in Visalia, especially in downtown Visalia, that brings people in. And this past weekend was just a perfect example of this. It was an incredible amount of things to do in Visalia. And pretty much every weekend there's a lot to do, from the symphony to community theater productions to music at the Solidor or other downtown spots. It's a really happening place.
And I try to make it to Visalia whenever I can, and there's always so much to do. There also seems to be, at least from my perspective, a real do-it-yourself spirit. Do you see that as well?
Definitely. Over the years, we've had this organization called Sound and Vision, which is run by a school teacher and musician from Tulare. His name is Aaron Gomes. And he's, through his own connections in the music business and shoe leather, have put together this incredible contact list where we get these hot up-and-coming music acts that are traveling the state, going either to San Francisco or Los Angeles, and they're stopping in Visalia to perform. It's kind of a perfect location because we get them going either way, you know, to Southern California or San Francisco. And pretty much every weekend we have one of these bands performing at a venue in downtown Visalia. It's really neat.
Tell me about some of the people who are going to be sharing the stage with you at Arts Visalia on Thursday night, some of your panelists. Let's start with Rosalinda Verde.
She's a fascinating lady. She started the Visalia Opera Company. She grew up in Tulare County, went away to school, and came back, and is very involved in the arts community and started the Visalia Opera Company that does a big operatic production once a year. They're hoping to expand this by offering more than just one production a year, but they've done The Marriage of Figaro and Hansel and Gretel and a bunch of other productions over the years, and it's been quite interesting. And she gets singers from the Visalia area, but also Fresno and all up and down the Central Valley.
Another one of those people like Aaron Gomes, who you mentioned, that
right.
really has taken on something and is doing their dream, living their dream, and sharing with the community. Caroline Kuntz is also on your panel. Tell us about her.
She is the sort of the coordinator of the Arts Consortium, which is a countywide organization that all the various arts groups, the community theater groups, the galleries, they all come together once a month and let everyone know what they're doing and plan, promote, make sure everyone knows is on the same page and know what all these various art organizations are doing. And pretty much every organization is part of the Arts Consortium. It's a great resource. It's a very smart thing to do.
And then you also have Richard Peterson from COS to join you. He's going to be talking about how some of the other elements fit into the picture, correct?
Correct. We have COS has a really vibrant community theater production with that they there are student actors, and they also get people from the community to do production. They're one of actually this weekend and next. They're putting on a play called Two Governors, a British comedy farce. They have a really active art gallery at COS. They have the Arts and Lecture Series that brings in interesting dance and authors and all kinds of interesting things to the symphony. And Arts Visalia, which is our public gallery in downtown, is actually the curator is Kevin Bowman, who is from COS. He's an art instructor at COS. It's his side job. So COS is a really big part of the whole arts and culture scene in Visalia.
Again, if you just joined us today, we're talking with James Ward of the Visalia Times-Delta. He's moderating a panel discussion that is coming up Thursday night in Visalia called Can the Arts Revive a Town? It's hosted by Zocalo Public Square, and Valley Public Radio is a media sponsor of the event. A lot of the focus of this event is in talking about how the arts have a multiplier effect in supporting regional economies and building communities and things like that. And in talking with Joe Matthews of Zocalo, he said a lot of communities haven't fared as well as Visalia with this strategy. And Visalia is something of the model for doing this right. You mentioned downtown Visalia as being a place where so many of these things happen. How much of that do you think can be attributed to the arts?
I think a lot of it is because We have all these great restaurants in downtown Visalia. Pretty much every type of cuisine and price point you could think of, from the Vintage Press, which has a reputation for being one of the best restaurants in the Central Valley, to artisan pizza places. And when you've got a lot of things happening, and we've got the vibrant movie theater, you've got all these live music places, live theaters. People come eat dinner, shop, hang out in downtown before or after the productions, and it just draws people to downtown. I think another real key here is that Kauai Delta Medical Center, the city many years ago convinced them to stay in downtown and expanded in downtown. With all those hospital workers and doctors and people coming down to the hospital right in downtown, has been invaluable too, because you get all these people here. You can't discount the importance of Kauai Delta to downtown Visalia. It's critical. And we also have a lot of free parking, which is is always good. We've got a parking garage and a lot of lots, which is a great thing that the city did, decided many years ago that they get a plenty of parking in the area.
Now, the city also has seen its struggles in certain areas, such as with the Oval Park, recently the cancellation of the Buddy Guy and Peter Frampton concert generated a lot of headlines and a lot of community discussion about exactly how that effort is going. Do you think this strategy can be applied to something like Oval Park, or maybe that's actually what they're trying to do? What do you think about that?
I think they are trying to do it, and they had a replacement for the performers that canceled. Coming up, in, I think, on the 23rd, a Christian artist named John McMillan will be performing at the Oval Park. It's going to be free. It's going to be a lot smaller than the concert with Buddy Guy and all the guitar players. But I think they took a step back and said, let's do something smaller, but we still want a musical act. So he's performing on the 23rd. So, yeah, I think they saw what the arts and music and did to downtown Visalia, and they're hoping to do the same thing around Oval Park.
Again, James Ward, lifestyle editor for the Visalia Times-Delta. He's hosting this event for Zocalo Public Square on Thursday night at Arts Visalia. It's called Can the Arts Revive a Town? You can find more information online at zocalopublicsquare.org. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Across the valley, it's finally starting to feel like fall. The heat of summer finally seems to have passed us by. The nights are longer, and leaves are just beginning to turn from a deep green to shades of yellow and amber. Another sign of fall? Apples from small orchards in mountain communities, and specifically the Springville Apple Festival. Judy King, the event chair of the 34th annual event, joins us now on Valley Edition. Judy, welcome.
Well, thank you.
The festival takes place this weekend in Springville. Before we talk about the festival, tell us a little about Springville for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with exactly where this Tulare County mountain community is located.
Springville is a small community that is off the Highway 190, just north of Porterville. And we have about 1,000 residents that are spread around 25 square mile area, but we have a small town atmosphere, but a lot of beautiful scenery.
And it indeed is a very beautiful part of Central California. This is the 34th event, but the tradition of apples in Springville goes back even before that, decades and decades before that. I understand the mountain community has had a long history as a center for growing apples.
Yes, it has, and that's kind of what inspired the community club years ago, well, 34 years ago, to have the Apple Festival, because we wanted to bring the Valley community to Springville to let them know about our apple tradition and all of the many apple orchards that we have in the area.
So what is that apple tradition? What makes it special?
Well, other than cattle, the apple orchards were the primary business in Springville, and they basically helped this community to thrive early on in the 40s and 50s, and it has continued on. We've lost a few of our orchards, but we still have many that are in the area, and people are really not aware of it.
So what sort of apples are grown in the Springville area?
Well, pretty much just your standard apples. I'm not an apple expert. Being chair of the apple committee doesn't make me an apple expert necessarily.
Well, as long as you like them.
Yes, exactly. And at the festival, we have many of our local orchards that bring their wares to the festival, and then we try to make sure that a lot of our specialty items that we have are concerned with apples. So you can get the Women's Club will make apple pies. Our Veterans of Foreign War make a special apple burrito that is famous throughout the valley. And you can get apple cobblers and apple crepes, pretty, and apple butter, obviously, and apple jam. But that's part of what we still focus on.
I'm very intrigued by the apple burrito. Tell me more about the festival. I also understand you have a 7-mile mountain bike race and some other things that are going on for this family-friendly festival.
Yeah, we basically only allow craft and food vendors at the Apple Festival, and that was another reason why the community club started this, was because there are so many retired individuals plus very crafty individuals in Springville that basically it gave them an opportunity to display some of the things that they make and to sell those items. And our festival is still basically focused on local craft persons and local artisans. We have photographers and oil painters and quilters and embroidery and woodworking and stained glass. All of those things are for sale. Now, we have two events that happen in conjunction with the Apple Festival over the weekend. On Saturday morning, you have runners can compete in a 10K, a 5K, a kids' half-mile run, and a 2K walk. And that starts at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and it's called the Apple Run. And then on Sunday morning, bikers can compete in the Fat Tire Classic Mountain Bike Race, which is a 7-mile course that runs through one of our local ranches along the streams and pastures through the ranch, and it's beautiful scenery, and it's very competitive races, all of them are, so is a lot of fun for those that come and compete or just come to cheer on their favorite runners or bikers.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking about the 34th annual Springville Apple Festival that takes place this weekend in the community of Springville that is just above Lake Success on Highway 190. I guess you could say kind of halfway between Camp Nelson and Porterville, right? Would that be accurate to say?
I would say that's very accurate on the 190, yes.
You mentioned that a lot of people don't know that Springville is a center for these old apple orchards that go back decades. Why do you think that is? How has it been such a secret all these years?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure why that is. I think they really... most of the orchards, they don't market their apples as much as they sell them to local individuals. And I came up from Orange County, and I happen to know people that live down there that used to make trips up here just to get apples because they had known about them when they were kids living in Lindsay or somewhere else. And it's basically... a very well-kept secret for quality apples.
We have just about a minute or so left. If people want more information or want to go to the festival, what should they do and what should they know?
Well, first they should know that admission is free, and we have everybody parks at our Springville Sierra Rodeo grounds, and there are shuttles that will drive everyone up to downtown Springville where the event is held. And they can reach us on our website, which is www.springville.ocsnet.net/applefest, which is very long. Or they can just search for Springville Apple Festival on the web to get information. But we're basically open from 9 to 5 on Saturday and 9 to 4 on Sunday, and hopefully everybody will join us.
Well, it sounds like a very tasty way to spend the weekend in the mountains of Tulare County. Again, our guest today, Judy King, the event chair of the 34th Annual Springville Apple Festival. Judy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. You can also see more stories in the series Fits and Starts on the website, again, kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. And if you're on Twitter, follow us online. We are @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.